Afternoon. Appreciate you folks who are here, and today we are going to be hearing a public hearing on a number of bills that are related to health and rural health specifically. As if you recall, we had a little discussion earlier, public hearings on some of these bills. So, Elizabeth, if you would, I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2514, and Elizabeth, if you would be give us a brief reminder of this bill. We will ask folks to come up in a minute to tell us more.
Okay, Chairman Berger and committee members, again, all three of these bills that you have are dealing with that Medicare provider tax, the rural Medicare medical provider tax. So this House Bill 2514, this is just adding licensed psychologists to the list of rural medical providers who then can qualify for the rural medical provider tax. It allows the Office of Rural Health to identify the rural area for which psychologists can provide psychological services, which qualifies then the provider for the tax credit. It provides the Office of Rural Health the authority to establish criteria for certifying individuals as eligible for this tax credit. It applies to tax years beginning on or after January 1st, 2009. So this is the one that begins in January 1st, 2009, where the other two begin in January 1st, 2006. Now, I did do a revenue impact just for this particular component for the psychologist, and then beginning it out in 2009, I have a small portion of it in the 2008-09 fiscal year, so it's a reduction of $266,800 in the 07-09 biennium just for that one fiscal year, and then as you go out, 2009-11 fiscal year, basically $667,000 per year. And then you, so by the 2009-11 biennium, $1.3 million, and that's, you know, roughly not assuming too much growth in psychologists out there in the rural areas. Now, this is all rural areas. So there was some talk last time about maybe narrowing it just to the frontier counties, mm-hmm. but I have not gotten that information yet from the Office of Rural Health. Right now, they've found that 129 psychologists are basically qualifying in all rural areas. So if you want to narrow it further to just the frontier counties, then we need additional information from the Office of Rural Health. No, look into that. But I would, again, remind you that if we don't get additional amendments to a bill like this and we get testimony on how many are in the frontier counties, I'm still going to have to write this as a range in the revenue impact, because you're not putting it into the statute that it has to be in a frontier rural county. Okay, so you're still leaving it up to the discretion of the Office of Rural Health to establish those criteria, and it doesn't say that the criteria has to, you know, just be in the frontier counties. So just recognize at this point that's why I put these higher end estimates, and granted it could be smaller revenue loss, but at this point we don't have an amendment that does that.
Questions of Elizabeth? Okay, then let's ask Damiana Merriweather and Robert Lundblad from the Oregon Psychological Association, and welcome them.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Damiana Merriweather, and I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Psychological Association. I appreciate this opportunity to bring this bill before the committee today, and I appreciated the chance to begin having this conversation last week. The chair indulged me because of my broken leg, so he said. But I want to just begin with the bill as it's being introduced, talk very briefly. It's very simple, so just cover very briefly what it does. I have with me today Robert Lundblad, who's a psychologist intern at the Oregon State Hospital, and he is here today, one, just to help answer any questions you have about psychology and sort of what that is, and also to talk to you a little bit. He's here representing his colleagues who would directly benefit from this change, but who all, one, work a long ways away, and two, are very, very busy, and so are not able to join us. So House Bill 2514 is very straightforward. It adds psychologists to the list of qualified healthcare providers who would be eligible to apply for the rural provider tax credit. This tax credit already exists in statute, as Lizbeth spoke to very briefly. It is currently available to rural physicians, osteopaths, nurse practitioners, podiatrists, dentists, physician's assistants, nurse anesthetists, and optometrists. So as I quickly ran through that list, you'll notice there are no specific mental health providers there at all. Obviously, psychiatrists are physicians and are qualified, but there are very few psychiatrists statewide, and even fewer of them practicing in rural communities, and they have that opportunity to access this. So we see this as a real area of healthcare that is being neglected in terms of promoting bringing those providers into rural communities. And there's a real true and demonstrated need. I'm sure many of you on the committee could speak at great length to what you see in your own districts in terms of inadequate resources to help people and as they help, they try to seek help for themselves or their family members for mental illness or emotional disturbance. The second piece is a delayed implementation. This came up in conversation last week. I'd be happy to, you know, sort of touch on more details of this. This was the delayed implementation was at the suggestion of the chair, who was also the chief sponsor of the bill, as a way to allow us to build up to implementation, to use it as a tool for recruiting Oregon graduates as they come out of psychology programs to get them to stay and practice here in Oregon and to move into those communities. So a way of trying to begin addressing the problem but also being mindful of the revenue challenges and the fiscal challenges that the state faces. We had some discussions about management tools. I know Karen Whitaker is here and can speak far more knowledgeably and eloquently to the tools that are available to her office to manage this program. I just received the revenue impact right now when you did, so I haven't had a chance to review it at length, although I am curious about whether or not there was an assumption of full utilization of the full $5,000 utilization by every person who would qualify, which I think would be an incorrect assumption. Most of these folks don't make enough money that they would have enough obligation that they would be able to fully realize. So I'm sure Lizbeth could answer that question and clarify what she took into her calculations in making that decision. So that's the bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Or
thank you, Damian. Staff, did you want to respond to the numbers issue?
Chairman Butler and committee members, so initially with this bill, again, it's assuming at the beginning level as far as 129. I assume that 80% would take it of those that are active in the rural areas. And then I assumed also that that a portion of it, meaning the 80%, would then take it in future years as far as a carry forward, because you do have a carry provisions and stuff. So basically with initially, I'm assuming that a portion of them do take it, but as far as the tax liability, that's reduced 20% in a given year. But, we've got statistics now from the Department of Revenue, and there's not a whole lot of unused tax credit. I mean, that's just clear of the different providers. And I don't think psychologists are going to be that much more underpaid than MDs and dentists and nurses, and so, you know, you've got a whole list there, and we have merged that data from the last meeting we had on the Senate side, because there was testimony that these are basically personal income taxpayers that wouldn't have tax liability, but looking at the personal income tax data, it clearly is not true. So, and it's, you know, you were given that information, I'm sure, just at the last hearing, as everyone else was, as far as the amount of tax liability that was being used on that credit.
What does it say now?
There was some mention of this carryover. This is user.
No, this is. I'm sorry. It does not allow a carry forward. It's just right. Each year
it's
you use it, and or you don't
right.
Get it.
Okay. Robert Lundblad.
Hi. Well, for the record, my name is Robert Lundblad. I hold a doctorate in psychology from George Fox University, and I'm a psychologist resident at Oregon State Hospital, which means I'm not licensed yet, but a little more than an intern. And I'm also a member of the Oregon Psychological Association and a member of the Legislative Committee. And I think one thing that's been interesting about our Legislative Committee is that this last couple of years we've really kind of zeroed in on rural health issues. And we have members of the committee that are from the Bend area, from LeGrand, and from Pendleton. And I think each one of them kind of echoes the same story, is that there's more of a need for the services out there than there is a supply of servicers. And that results in them having to kind of balance between how much are they going to manage their workload and how much are they going to take on extra work. And in listening to them, I think sometimes they take on a little bit more workload than most psychologists, if they had a choice, would do. I know there's a fellow, Dr. Douglas Marlowe in Pendleton. He on a regular basis sees clients over 12 hours every day, and has a 3-month waiting list from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. Dr. David Wade, working in Hood River, about the same issue. I think one thing that he talks about is it's very difficult to get somebody to locate into a rural area, and one reason why it's difficult to locate into a rural area because oftentimes the career pathway for a psychologist is to go work within a clinic or work within a place like a state hospital or work at the VA in Portland and then begin private practice. But for somebody to take off and head to John Day or Burns or Pendleton, it takes a leap of faith to go out there and want to start a practice without any help whatsoever. And I think that, you know, a crossover to that is that hospitals in the area also have a difficult time maintaining their staff of psychiatrists and psychologists because the lure is, the financial lure is just too great to go somewhere else, even though you've got the spectacular beauty and great lifestyle of Eastern Oregon. Southern Oregon, it just begins to not be able to compensate you enough.
Thank you very much, Dr. Lundblad. Questions of Damiana or Meriwether or Dr. Lundblad? Thank you very much. Appreciate your both being here, and we'll discuss this bill amongst the committee members about moving it forward. I do appreciate the opportunity we've had of reviewing with you, using this as a potential recruitment tool to attract some of these folks and to get them scattered out into the rural area where we do have a lifestyle.
And Mr. Chair, if I may, just briefly, in addition to my testimony, I provided you with a map of what qualifies as urban and rural and frontier counties. Just this is an issue that came up at the last hearing, and there was some discussion and asked for clarification, and so that should be with the materials that came to you from the administrator. So for those of you who aren't as familiar with what that map looks like, and just for your reference, there are currently 5 psychologists practicing in frontier counties. 2 of them are in Baker, but one of whom is actually has been trying to retire for about a year, but she can't find anyone to replace her, and the need there is so great that she hasn't felt like she can step away from her practice. So just to answer the questions that came up.
So there's 5 in frontier counties.
Correct.
If we limited this to frontier counties to start off with, you're really looking at a $25,000 per year credit if they could use 100% of it.
If they could use 100%.
Using the calculations that staff has used, it'd be a $20,000 a year if you limit it to frontier. Well, I appreciate knowing that, and we'll continue to work this. If there's members that would like to approach, I do know that a couple members would like to see it continue to move forward. In that regard, I would like to thank you. I would like to probably have an opportunity in the interim to take a look at, as we're looking at other credits, all other credits, I'd like to look at the effectiveness of this particular type of credit in actually bringing folks to these counties, as opposed to just trying to flock shoot these credits out there. My concern is that I'll just be real frank with you. As a tax practitioner, I frequently would see these folks using these credits, but their income is really not sufficient. I mean, even MDs their sufficient their income after paying liability insurance is just not even sufficient to have earned the $10,000 or $5,000 credit. And so what happens is that they put their spouse to work, and basically by the two of them putting all of their efforts into rural Oregon, they can come up with enough income that they can use a $5,000 credit.
Right.
And that's one way of keeping them there too. I mean, you've got two jobs that they have to hold down in order to earn the $5,000 credit. So, but I don't know that that's good public policy either. I don't know that it's doing what we intended for the credits to do. So, be on alert, Damiana, that that's something we do need to visit about as we work forward. Representative Comp is recognized.
It's a geography question. The question, Chairman Butler, and you probably know the answer, is where is Pendleton? Is it in rural or frontier?
Rural.
That's
rural.
Rural. Because there's Milton Freewater, and I don't know how far.
It's in rural.
Yeah.
Milton?
Yeah. Yeah, it's right.
Isn't
there,
it right up here at the top?
Right where the dark spot is.
Oh, well, I should...
It's
right
north
here.
Of Pilot Rock.
Yeah, just north of Pilot
Rock. Okay, because as Representative Boquist discussed last week when we first looked at this, Pendleton's just a real high need for some of our troops coming back for mental health support. Okay, that helps me think about what we need to do.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Boquist, would you like to consider the possibility of preparing an amendment to have this start in those frontier counties earlier than the 09?
Be delighted to research that for
you. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. With that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2514. Colleagues, we're scheduled for a public hearing on House Bill 2787. We'll open that public hearing.
Chairman Butler and committee members, with House Bill 2787, this is adding the certified emergency medical technicians to the list of rural providers who can qualify for the rural medical provider tax. And then it allows the Office of Rural Health to identify the rural areas for which the emergency medical technician services qualifies a technician for the tax credit. It allows the Office of Rural Health to establish the criteria then for certify those individuals as eligible for the tax credit. It applies to tax years beginning on or after January 1st, 2006. Now you have a dash one and a dash two in front of you. The dash two is what the State Pharmacy Association would like to bring forward. It improves on the dash one amendment that you heard in the last meeting. So basically with your dash two amendment, it is specifying that pharmacists be allowed to be eligible for the rural medical provider tax as well. And then there's also additional language to say that the qualified pharmacist cannot be part of a group of more than five pharmacies under common ownership in the area of health care need designated by the Office of Rural Health or in an area federally designated as a health shortage area or medically underserved area. So the pharmacist, before this meeting, I didn't get any information as far as the number of pharmacists, so I've just done a revenue impact on the existing bill, which is dealing with the EMTs. So with the EMTs, in the last meeting, we had testimony that there was 3,912 of them active in rural Oregon. So again, that became the starting basis for the revenue impact. Obviously, it's much larger than a psychologist because there are only 129 of those. So basically, assuming that 80% of them can use the credit, then you're going to be looking at a revenue loss beginning in 2005-06 because they would file in April of 06 for the credit. And And it's looking at a reduction of $5.6 million, $15.4 million in 06-07, and a 2007-09 biennium loss of $21 million. By 07-09 biennium, $37.9 million, and the 2009-11 biennium, $40 million in lost revenue. So basically, again, there was discussion about wanting this narrowed to the frontier counties, but I haven't gotten that information yet. On just the EMTs that are in frontier counties. And again, the pharmacists, I think someone can come testify to how many there are in rural areas, but I didn't have that ready yet for the impact statement.
Thank you very much, Elizabeth. Ed Patterson and Chris Benson. Are they here? And Chris Benson, is Chris Benson here as well? Okay. I'm sorry to wake you up in a sound sleep like that. right after lunch and everything. Please, gentlemen.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I am Ed Patterson, the executive director for the Oregon Rural Health Association. Our association was asked by the Northeast Oregon Area Health Education Center to support a tax credit for emergency medical technicians this session. The AHEC has been providing EMT training in rural parts of the state and became aware of the growing difficulty of recruiting and retaining emergency medical technicians in rural Oregon. I contacted you, Mr. Chairman, and asked if you would have a bill introduced to do this, and we would like to thank you for doing it. The AHEC took the lead in identifying the obstacles that occur in attempting to have a viable free hospital medical care system in the rural parts of the state. They found changing demographics in rural Oregon, with a younger population diminishing, providing fewer volunteers to perform the services, and a growing aging population in need of those services. Expensive education requirements and long travel distances to obtain the training paid for by the volunteer himself or herself personally is a deterrent to getting volunteers. Of course, the lagging rural economy and lower incomes of rural Oregonians is also a problem that has to be taken into consideration. This bill represents part of the solution by recognizing the personal commitment of the volunteers by rewarding them with a $5,000 state income tax credit. As you can see in the bill, there are several other rural health providers that qualify for this credit, and the Rural Health Association believes this concept can be a very valuable tool in recruiting and retaining EMTs. We thank you for the opportunity to testify and urge your committee support. I ask Chris Benson to be here, who is an EMT, and he can introduce himself and tell you what he does.
Chris. Thank you, Ed. Chris, welcome.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Chris Benson. I am an EMT paramedic. I'm also the EMS coordinator for Lane County Fire District 1. We cover about 200 square miles to the west and south of the Eugene area. We have a service population of about 15,000 over that 200 square miles, and it is, while close to the Eugene area, it is definitely rural. We have approximately 50 EMTs that respond for us, and of that, 45 of those respond in a volunteer capacity. It is incredibly difficult to bring people out of the community to make the commitment that's required in time and energy and money out of their own pocket to receive the EMT training, to continue on in the various levels of EMT training, and then to maintain that recertification over a period of time. We run into difficulty with the recruitment, as I said, but also difficulty with the retention. Part of the problem is that the average service span for a firefighter EMT is 3 to 5 years as a volunteer. And that means that we are consistently having to go out and recruit to fill vacancies as people leave. These are not positions that already exist as EMTs that we're trying to draw into the community. This is a little bit different. These are people that already exist within the community that we're trying to pull away from their job, their family, you know, soccer with the kids, all the other commitments that they have, and asking them to give some of that time back to the community, and to do that with no compensation. I believe this would be a significant benefit for that recruitment effort. Not only do EMTs provide emergency response, but in a lot of ways they're an extension of public health. That is amazing how many people utilize the EMS system almost as a primary care physician. And will call us for stuff that is really is public health issues. In Lane County, which would seem to be by population a fairly urban county, the reality is that 40% of the population in that county is served by volunteer EMS response. And the need is very significant.
Thank you very much, Chris. We appreciate it. Questions of the committee members of either Ed or Chris? Thank you very much. I did have one question that I was checking with staff here. 200 square miles, 15,000 people, that's 75 people per square mile. That still qualifies as rural. How many EMTs do you have, and how many ambulances do you roll?
We do not provide transport. Provide first response EMS. We have transport units that come from Eugene. So we are on scene 15 to 20 minutes in the majority of our district. In some portions of our district, we're on scene a half hour to 45 minutes prior to transport arriving. So we provide initial stabilization of the patient. Also, and we have 50 EMTs, 45 of those serve in a volunteer capacity.
Okay. Representative Berger is recognized.
Mr. Burns, would you say that those 45, on top of all the other things they do in life and then are also doing this on a volunteer basis, do they make enough to even qualify for a credit? I mean, I appreciate what you're saying. How hard it must be is my point, to get folks who are raising families, earning a living, and then get called out at any time and have to leave their family and their living in order to go on a call like this. I just wonder, members of the committee, if our numbers aren't a little high, because a lot of these folks aren't earning enough money in their real jobs because they're out doing volunteer service.
And I just want to clarify, too, so everyone's clear, Chairman Butler and Representative Berger, is that it's not just the tax liability of the medical provider themselves. They could be married to someone who also could have tax liability, and it goes against the entire tax return.
Right.
So it's the joint tax return.
Yeah.
They have to.
Yeah. Representative Esquivel.
And now, am I to assume that these volunteers, are they unpaid volunteers?
Yes. And part of the problem occurs that we cannot actually reimburse them because you can't volunteer for something you're paid to do. So once we pay them once, then we would have to pay them from there on out.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Hass and then Representative Wolfe.
A question for Elizabeth. I know we had that one bill that disallowed non-residents to file for the child care credit. Mm-hmm. These other credits, I guess, the rural health credit, does that allow for non-residents to take it up against their Oregon income?
Chairman Butler, Representative Hass, yes, it doesn't restrict it just to residents. I don't remember if there's a proration in there for part year, the non-resident, depending on the amount of income that they've earned here in Oregon or not. I'd have to look that up. But sometimes that's the way credits work for non-residents.
Well, sure, I just think that made some sense. I know it was just a minor technical bill with the child care bill, but I think to me that was very symbolic of some of the things we need to do on these tax credits, which is to kind of pare them down and figure out what's the most bang for the buck. And maybe if we took non-residents out of this one, for example, we could afford to add this bill, the one before, into this, so that it comes out to be a lower revenue hit.
Representative Boquist?
Question of Liz Beth, and then a follow-up question. I recall, it all blends together, a week or two, 2-3 weeks ago, we discussed an expense, an EMT expense bill, which would have allowed the EMTs to deduct their expenses. You know, basically, if it was a business expense, it would be
above the line.
That's correct, isn't it?
Right.
Yeah. Question to the gentleman here. I mean, if the two choices were there, I mean, what's better? Would it be better to have a volunteer EMT get his expenses taken off or a tax credit? Because I don't know a whole lot of EMTs going to be able to have one as part of a future son-in-law. He ain't going to get that $5,000, I can tell you that. He just doesn't make that kind of money. So
I would agree that there are very few of the EMTs are going to qualify for the full $5,000. With volunteers, it's difficult to say one way or the other because their service with us is completely independent of their income.
Mm-hmm.
As far as writing off the expenses, other than the initial training expense that they may incur, I'm not sure what other expenses they would be able to write off. For the most part, ongoing continuing education hours and training is provided by the agencies. There would be occasionally some personal expense there after the initial certification, but I think would be very limited.
And that's true as to some parts of the state of Oregon. That is not true. That is not true with regard to the frontier area. I mean, they have to come up with all of the money out of their pockets, and then still, you know, after the bake sales and cookie sales and so forth are done, then they still have to contribute to keep the ambulances running and to keep their training up. And then they got to come to Portland or Salem somewhere to get training frequently. And that's all at their own expense, and they're taking that time away from their jobs, and that's another issue. But I think my concern is that while we want to incentivize this continued activity, I think that we really need to exempt. For instance, what's to preclude someone at this particular point from being from out of state, taking the credit, and that could happen on a border community such as Nevada or Idaho or some very rural portions of Northern California, I suppose, with Lake County and Klamath County. While I don't want to discourage folks from volunteering, I also want to make the credit as close as we can linked with the amount of service. Ed, is the credit given for one full year of service, or what of the part year of service? If someone comes in and starts in November, even full-time volunteering?
Well, Mr. Chairman, the bill, if you read the details of it, is very nonspecific in that way.
Okay.
And one of the comments I would make is the first time I heard the number of some 3,000 plus EMTs, I think that includes paid staff.
Okay.
And if you also limit it, and I think the intent of the Office of Rural Health is to limit it to the volunteers,
right,
you would have a dramatic reduction in the total amount of credit cost.
But it still isn't specific as to whether they volunteered in a frontier county. Let's go down to Lakeview, and I've got someone down Pine Creek that's volunteering, and they start in November. Would they? And that's a frontier county. Would they qualify for a whole year's worth of credit?
Mr. Chairman, I think that would depend on how the administrative rules are written by the Office of Rural Health.
Yeah, there are administrative rules in place that I think that they have to have come through a full year. They have to have been here a full year. In the service of whatever it is, as a doctor, as a nurse, or in these really rural areas.
I believe that's where the doctor's tax credit is.
Right. It's after a full year or so. Thank you very much. Other questions? Yes, Representative Kahn.
Chairman Butler, is anybody or Elizabeth going to speak to the -1 and -2 amendments today?
I think that Elizabeth did, in fact,
did she
address
her,
except that... as to the pharmacists?
Yeah, Chairman Butler and Representative Comp. Yeah, the -2 is what the proponents would like. It just adds more clarification about the pharmacists that are going to qualify in the sense that you can't have the more than five different pharmacists under common ownership in the area of health care need designated by the Office of Rural Health. So basically it's adding pharmacists, but it is restricting it more than your -1 amendment by saying that they basically can't have more than five pharmacies that are all, you know, under common ownership in the rural areas. Thank
other,
you.
Other questions of staff or Ed?
Mr. Chair.
And Chris, yes.
Look, that was just brought up, you know, the intent was from volunteers. Is that because I understand it?
Chairman Butler, yeah, that's what they just said. Yeah.
Right, because, I mean, it's not in the bill.
That's not in the bill.
It's about certifying. I think we just heard in the previous hearing that certified was about, I don't remember the number, but.
Right.
We did the whole basic, we did the whole thing.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ed. And we have Tom Holt and Karen Whitaker Knapp.
Chairman Butler.
Yes.
As you're coming up, are we considering doing an amendment to incorporate some of these suggestions?
Yeah, the dash two would be with regard to the expanding the pharmacists.
And right.
I think we just need to hear that testimony and representing. Maybe we can get together on this.
Do the other things that we identified. Thank you.
Chair Butler, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tom Holt with the Oregon State Pharmacy Association. Our members are pharmacists and pharmacy technicians around the state. Here with the Dash 2 amendment, like other health professions, we're experiencing some pretty severe challenges with recruitment in the rural and frontier areas of the state, to the point where some communities are actually losing access to pharmacy services. And we would maintain that without access to pharmacy services, you really don't have access to health care. One of the things that has changed in the health care arena since this tax credit program was created is that prescription drugs, because of some of the developments that have occurred, have really become a primary means of treatment of many conditions. And we know from compliance data, what we call compliance, that is, how well does somebody follow through with their prescription drug therapy, the more obstacles they have that a patient has to getting their therapy, the less likely they are to follow through and get better. And that's sort of common sense. When we get out into rural areas, if we lose pharmacy services in a town, and all of a sudden people have to drive 25, 50 miles to get to the nearest pharmacy, that's a huge health care problem. And I'll just tell you one quick story that relates to that. Early this year, we lost a pharmacy in Merrill. It's a town down near the California border. Some of you may know where that is. The pharmacist there had been there since 1951. They simply could not hang on any longer. They were nearing 80 years old and just had not had any success in recruiting successors. There was nothing wrong with the business. I saw the numbers. Nothing wrong with the business. But for a variety of reasons, they were just having great difficulty getting anyone to come work there and ultimately had to throw in the towel. We would suggest that while adding pharmacists to the tax credit would not be a cure, it would give us a tool. And talking with some of our members who are in these very, very rural areas practicing at small pharmacies, you know, they're just grateful that this discussion is even going on. We have a list of a small number of folks that we already know are kind of on the cusp. They're looking at, they're past the age of normal retirement and would like to find successors. There's others that are planning a little further ahead and looking, gee, in 5 years, I need to find somebody, that kind of thing. So it would be a tool. It would also help some of those who are kind of struggling now to, as they're servicing more of the Medicaid population than other pharmacies tend to service. They're struggling just to keep the doors open. It would be helpful to them. The language in the Dash 2 is identical to language that we developed for Senate Bill 403 in consultation with Karen Whitaker and the Office of Rural Health. The criteria are, as staff mentioned, that the pharmacists would have to work at a pharmacy that's not part of a group of pharmacies of more than five pharmacies under common ownership. We picked that number because there are some arrangements where two or three pharmacies may have some minority shared ownership, and it's really an arrangement by which people cover each other on vacations and some things like that. But it keeps us out of the arena of having pharmacists who work for large chains who frankly have deep enough pockets, they can find ways to recruit people in other ways that the very small pharmacies don't have available to them. So we would commend to you the Dash 2 amendment to the bill. We would expect to work with Karen's office to further narrow the qualifications. By our estimate, looking very carefully in our database, we believe there's about 140 pharmacists statewide in rural and frontier areas who would qualify under just this initial language that we have come up with. Looking at some of the communities that would qualify, we frankly see some room to further narrow that. But to the chair's question of rural versus frontier, we did look earlier when we developed this initially at making that a cut. And while we'd be happy to have any kind of beginning to this for pharmacists, frontier would leave out a lot of areas of significant need, and at least as far as pharmacy is concerned.
What's the distance between Merrill or Malin and Klamath Falls?
Chair Butler, members of the committee, I believe that's something like about 25-30 miles.
30 miles.
But it's not easy travel in bad weather, as I understand. So
in Malin, do I have a pharmacy there?
I don't believe so, sir.
So nothing south of Klamath Falls to the border at this point?
Yeah.
Okay. Welcome, Karen. Nice to have you here.
Thank you, Chair Butler. For the record, my name is Karen Knapp. I just got married.
Congratulations.
Thank you. So I'm transitioning to a new name, so I know it's confusing. It is for me, too. And I'm the director of the OHSU Center for Rural Health, which includes the Office of Rural Health. And with me is Scott Ekblad, who is the director of the Office of Rural Health. And I wanted to share with you what type of process we might use to develop the criteria that are specified in House Bill 2787 to determine eligibility for the tax credit. In the past, when we have been given discretion to prepare eligibility standards, what we have done is put together an ad hoc committee of the types of practitioners who are affected and tried to determine what would be reasonable and also look at what the needs are. Because I think it's important for us to keep in mind that these credits, while they do affect individuals, are not intended to benefit individuals. They're intended to benefit the communities that the individuals are serving and to make sure that they have the health care that they need. So what we would do is look at communities statewide, see where the needs are. Certainly one way to do it is to look at frontier versus rural, because we know there are some natural assumptions you can make about the lack of availability of all types of health care in frontier counties. But sometimes there are other ways to do this. For example, when we adopted the credit for the dentists, we looked at dentists who were taking care of Medicaid patients and asked them to assure us that they would do that if they accepted the credit, and also that they would have a relationship with their hospital, that they would see emergency patients in the emergency room. And we have continued to periodically audit the rural areas to make sure that those relationships exist. So there are a lot of options open to us. We would consult with the affected practitioners and try to come up with criteria that would meet the needs of rural communities. Scott has prepared some estimates of revenue impact. I think he has also worked with Elizabeth. It's very difficult, particularly with EMTs, to assess what the revenue impact would be, because as Elizabeth said, people file joint returns. It's not based on the income necessarily of the provider who's affected. And also, we don't really know with volunteers what types of income they have or what types of professions they're engaged in. We do know, however, that increasing numbers of employers are not allowing their workers to take time off to serve as volunteers if they get a call while they're working, or they don't get paid if they take time off to be volunteers. And this is understandable, I suppose, in some regard for the employers, because it's a loss of productivity for them. But it certainly discourages people from continuing to volunteer. So I'm going to let Scott go through those figures with you. And we've also recently completed a survey of EMS agencies, and he'll share some of that information with you as well.
Thank you, Karen, and congratulations on your recent nuptials.
Thank you very much.
Chair Butler, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott Ekblad, and I'm with the Oregon Office of Rural Health. I don't believe that the material I've prepared has been handed out to you yet, because I've prepared a grouping based on all three of the bills that you're hearing on the tax credit today, and the very top page says House Bill 3348, and since that hasn't come up yet, I bet that's why it hasn't been handed out. But I prepared some scenarios, revenue impact scenarios, for EMTs, for physicians, for pharmacists, and for psychologists, and of course, most of it is just guessing as to how much a particular professional is going to be able to claim toward the maximum tax credit. For pharmacists, for example, just to look at a few different figures, and on the pharmacist, that would be, looks like the top of page two for you. For example, if all 799 rural pharmacists were eligible for the $5,000 state income tax credit and half of them were able to claim the full amount, a quarter were able to claim 75% and a quarter were able to claim 50% of the tax credit, that would add up to $3.2 million. Now, I understand that the parameters of the bill that we're discussing today would narrow that down considerably. So that's by far the top figure. Under scenario B on that same page, if we looked at, for example, just the pharmacists in frontier areas, according to our records, there are 64. And if, for example, 25% were able to claim the full amount, 50 were able to claim 75%, and a quarter were able to claim 50% of the tax credit, that would be a revenue impact of only $240,000.
Okay. Scott and Karen, let me ask this question relative to these credits. Has there ever been any discussion about the possibility of limiting the credit to just the affected spouse on a joint return? In other words, we're talking about an additional calculation so that that spouse would have to have had for a $5,000 tax credit, and that spouse would have had to have perhaps $60,000 worth of income. Mm-hmm. Any discussion of that having ever been had? That way, what happens is that the volunteer is that his or her income would be affected by the tax credit, but not necessarily the joint filing spouse.
Well, Mr. Chair, that's a good question, but no, it has not been discussed as far as I know. I think this would involve a fair amount of amendments to the tax code, and since we're also tied to the federal tax code, I think it would get pretty complicated.
So this is
the credit. Yeah.
Oh, okay. But in terms of people filing separately or filing jointly, whether they would have to breaking down their income, I think it would be kind of complicated. It would be something the Department of Revenue could answer much better than we could, because we just look at eligibility.
Well, and from your testimony, Karen, you're saying that you're not really considering what it does for the individual as much as you are how can we attract that kind of capability to this particular area.
That's
so
correct.
If we're offering $5,000 worth of credit for one particular area to try and get a pharmacist or a dentist or an EMT or other medical professional, then that's what it's going to take to get that medical professional or those medical professionals out there. And so I guess what I'm wondering is, again, the concern that I've got is just to make sure that we do try and target for the socioeconomic benefit, not just what kind of a credit can we give away for someone who is practicing in this particular area.
Yes, Representative Butler, I agree with you.
And I appreciate, Scott, your information about the rural pharmacists in frontier areas. And believe me, I'm very aware of that, as I've got one pharmacy that actually services about 5,000 square miles. right now. And that's a problem. That's a sincere problem. Representative Berger is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of questions of this panel, if you would indulge me a minute. The pharmacist piece seems a little different, notwithstanding the problem's the same. I understand that, but we were discussing earlier the EMTs and specifically saying, well, let's look at the volunteer EMTs as opposed to the paid ones. The pharmacists presumably are in the pharmacy business and get paid for it. To keep their license, they have to be pretty, they're like doctors or dentists or whatever. How would you get around the fact that there might be a pharmacist, if you did it, you discussed criteria, and I don't live in the rural, so maybe this isn't an issue, but it seemed to me that if Chair Butler's theoretical pharmacist out in the hinterland qualifies for a tax credit, but the one that works in the Safeway store in Ontario doesn't, and you're in the same county, that you're not offering some sort of an unfair business advantage, if you will, in some way in here. And the other issue is, what about internet pharmacy offerings? And I know but
you go ahead.
Well, they're great if you want diagnosis.
Well, but you understand what I'm saying. I mean, is there some intelligent way of doing internet pharmacy, not the way that we all know it on our on our emails. I mean, we all know how ridiculous that is, but that doesn't mean. Well, we won't discuss. But you understand the question, and it is a sincere question, because there might be some intelligent way of doing this.
Chair Butler, Representative Berger, let me take the last part of your question first in regard to internet. If I understand your question, I think what you're getting at is there an ability to provide services remotely?
Exactly.
The answer is yes, and in fact, we've made arrangements to do that in a couple of communities. But it's very, very limited. What can be done is to place basically a machine in a clinic where the pharmacist can remotely provide information to the patient, but you can only keep a very limited number of products on hand. You can't have anything that's temperature sensitive. You have a very limited formulary of things that you can use that for, and the presumption is the patient's going to have to, if they need more complex drug therapy, they're going to have to make their way to a pharmacy. It's a very poor substitute for in-person care when someone has a serious health condition. So yes, you can meet some needs that way, but it's not at all a substitute for having more comprehensive pharmacy services available. And that in-person relationship is really critical. There's a study came out just last year, toward the end of the year, about what a big difference it makes in outcomes for a person to see their pharmacist face-to-face and know who they are. And there is an enormous difference. I can't remember the percentages off the top of my head, but it was a very big number in terms of how much better people do in terms of complying with their drug therapy and getting better, being able to manage a chronic condition. So, it's in case of Merrill, we work with Karen's office to identify someone who could put a remote box in the rural health clinic there, but they still would prefer to have a pharmacist in that community. As to the other part of your question of, is there something inherently unfair to, a chain drug store in providing a credit to the independent pharmacy, I suppose you could make that argument. However, I would just say that the chains, they have resources they can turn to for recruitment. Some will pay bonuses for signing on, agreeing to be in a certain area for 2, 3, 5, even 5 years. The communities that we've crafted this language around largely are so small that they aren't of interest to a chain in many cases. A chain will never be interested in going to Merrill, Oregon. What happened to that pharmacy is the records went to a chain in Klamath Falls. And so the patient's service there have to go to Klamath Falls now or find some other way of getting service, or I would suspect in many cases they're just not getting service. They're skipping their drug therapy.
Thank you, Paul.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Is the language, though, in the rule, not in the bill, as to the criteria that... Do you understand what I'm questioning here? Because I don't read in here that it has to be Merrill. I'm reading rural. So in the past, has this gone by rule that by rule you define what the qualifiers are? She's nodding.
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, I don't know that we've ever been tasked with a situation exactly like this before, because a pharmacy is a business.
Exactly, and that's what is striking me as a little different.
It is.
Than what, I mean, yes, a doctor is a business, a dentist is a business in some sense, but it's a professional business. A pharmacy is under a sort of a different umbrella generally, and that's why I'm kind of questioning a little sharper here.
You ask a very intriguing question, and I don't know that we really have a good answer for you. I think the issue of internet and also mail order, which would be related to that, comes down to, however, the difference between acute and chronic care. And when you bring a child into the clinic and the child has an ear infection and you need an antibiotic very soon in order to treat that infection, if you have to drive 40, 50, 60 miles to get the drugs, then that's a delay of care for the child. If you, on the other hand, have hypertension and you know every month what you're going to need, then you can order those things by mail order. But the fact is that the loss of business to the small rural pharmacies because of mail order and because of internet and because they've lost business on the chronic care drugs has really contributed to the demise of some of the rural pharmacies. And, of course, some insurance companies will only pay if you receive your drugs in that way. But that trend has exacerbated the problem for the rural pharmacies. And I don't know that it's within the realm of any of us to resolve that, but that does explain some of why it's been difficult for them to carry on.
Follow-up.
Yeah, I'm just a comment. She's outlined, I think, the problem that I was trying to get at, and I'm just not sure that this mechanism is going to make a huge impact. Not that I'm against it, Mr. Chair, in some of the other issues that are particularly in the pharmacy realm going to, I mean, it's as you say, they're not making it on the day-to-day mm-hmm. business that pharmacies make it on as a business. And this doesn't begin to solve that whole issue. Sure. Thank you very much for tolerating all of this.
So a lot of
sort of poking.
A lot of other ancillary products are going to have to be sold by other people.
Yeah, true.
Other questions, Representative Boquist?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Looking at your handout here, we're now in the healthcare policy business here. I'm trying to figure this out. You have a chart on the back side, and then on the front side you have a list of the current recipients. I'm looking under MDs, and you have 988 claims across that line up there out of 1,104. If you flip to the back page, I see there's a whole host of categories down there. Where would those people be located? Are they only in the urban frontier or rural, or are they in the mixed urban-rural, or would a doctor in Salem or Corvallis be getting these credits too, or help me out? Thank you.
Chair Butler, Representative Boquist, to answer your question, those folks would be in frontier and in rural and in parts of the mixed urban-rural. So frontier is a subcategory of rural.
So, follow-on question, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up, Representative.
So really, in your, when you sit down at the Office of Rural Health, I mean, you have frontier, you have definitely rural, and then you have a mixed urban-rural in which you make a determination inside each county that mm-hmm. this is Alsea, so it's rural, and this is Corvallis, and it's urban, or is that what we're talking about?
Mr. Chair, Representative Boquist, we use a precise definition. It's 10 or more miles from a population centroid of 30,000 or more. And so we use actually GIS mapping now to determine who is eligible and who is not. So Corvallis would not be eligible. Salem would not be eligible. Although Representative Haas's question, I think, is kind of germane, because we do have people who live in Salem and may live in Corvallis and who may practice in a rural area, and we also have people who live in White Salmon, Washington, and practice in Hood River, or who live across the border in Idaho and who practice in Ontario, and they do take the tax credit. So people don't necessarily live in the rural area, but they practice there. And this gives them an incentive to travel to practice in that rural area.
Follow-up.
I mean, obviously you're vested in the program. I guess the real question I'm driving out here is, how effective is this? Because we're talking about some fairly hefty expansion. And is it really effective in reaching those that we want to reach? I mean, I could easily look at the 998 who claimed and say, well, how many of those are in the $250,000 or more category? I mean, so but the question is, I mean, in your, obviously you're the professional and we're the lay people here. So does this really work, or is this a program that could be fine-tuned?
Mr. Chair, Representative Boquist, we believe this is the strongest tool we have for recruiting physicians, nurse practitioners, PAs, and the other affected practitioners to rural areas. Having said that, it's a difficult program to evaluate objectively. If you ask someone, we've just given you $5,000, are you pleased? You know, of course they all say yes. But what we need to find out is what role that plays in their decision to come to a rural area and to stay there. And so we have two ways to find that out. One of them is anecdotal, talking to the person in our office who does the recruiting and finding out whether or not that credit really makes a difference, and the various recruiters that we've had, Scott is one of them, used to be his job, assure us that it is a very important deciding factor. The other thing is to look at what factors influence physicians and other professionals' decisions to practice in a rural community. And the survey that the Oregon Medical Association just completed shows that there is some difference between urban and rural physicians in those factors. Of the top five factors for rural physicians influencing their satisfaction with their practice, all five were financial. They had to do with overhead, Medicare reimbursement, Medicaid reimbursement, the fact that they don't get as large an income as their urban counterparts. So we know that financial factors are very important to them, and if we want to induce rural physicians to stay there and more to practice, that we have to address those financial issues.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much. We appreciate you being here.
Thank you, Representative Butler.
With that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2787. And we will open a public hearing on House Bill 3407. I'm sorry. You're right. Let's do 3348 first. We'll put on hold 3407, and we'll open a public hearing on 3348, continuing on with the health care. Excuse me.
Chairman Butler and committee members, with House Bill 3348, this bill then is the general bill dealing with all rural medical providers, and it is increasing then their annual maximum cap for that tax credit to $10,000 beginning tax year 2006 and beyond, and then it indexes that maximum annual cap to changes in inflation beginning tax year 2007. So basically, with this, it is doubling the size of it. That's why the revenue impact is large. But basically, what I also got and what was given out in the last meeting is a variety of statistics from the Department of Revenue, where they merged the list from the Office of Rural Health as far as the number, the practitioners that claim the credit, and then Department of Revenue looked at their tax returns in 2003 and looked at how much additional tax was owed for these various returns. So they basically went through 1,455 of those returns, and they found that only 328 of them had zero tax owed, which means they would have additional tax liability in order to be able to use an additional increase in the credit limit. So basically, this is relying on that, this statistical merging. It's not relying on any just assumptions. It's taking this, the very first table there, and just looking at the total amount that was still left there in the amount of tax owed, and looking at, okay, if you had the maximum amount of $5,000 that could be claimed by each one of these candidates, you know, which one is lower? Is it the tax owed, or is it the maximum of $5,000? So looking at that, because there's additional $9.7 million in tax liability that these practitioners still owe and paid to the state of Oregon in 2003. So these are not taxpayers that had no tax liability after they already used $5,000 of a tax credit. So, and I want to be clear, too, some people can use two credits already, because if you are a doctor and you're, say, a nurse practitioner, and as a couple, you could claim this credit twice already. You could already claim $10,000. So you already have some with two licenses, as we saw, and that's the third table down there. You can see there's 63 that claim two licenses already in tax year 2003. And so this is just allowing those tax returns to have a maximum credit of $10,000. So looking at the existing tax owed and how much we could use of that with this, going up to $10,000, what I found was that basically for all the different categories until you got up to the last one there where you got 633, not quite 50% of the tax returns had more than $5,000 in tax liability. Well, that's telling you that those folks then they paid $8.5 million in additional taxes, but they're the only ones that are, you know, that would be using the full $5,000 when you go up to the $10,000. So even making all those adjustments where everyone below that was claiming less than the $5,000, you still have a revenue loss and beginning in about roughly $5 million a year from going from $5,000 to $10,000 as far as revenue impact. So for the biennium, it's roughly $10
million. Thank you. I want to invite Ed Patterson and Karen Knapp.
Mr. Chair, if I finish my doctoral dissertation, can I get this credit?
If you qualify to practice in a rural area.
All right.
That's a double degree. You can run the pharmacy and be the psychologist down in Merrill. How's that?
And Scott Gallant, please come forward as well, Scott. Or do you have you and Tim? Okay. Karen?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I know that Scott Ekblad from our office has already given you prepared testimony on this bill, and so I didn't prepare the same written testimony over again, but what I wanted to reiterate is that we know that this tax credit works. It is the strongest tool that we have to recruit and retain the existing practitioners, and that it has not been changed since it was passed in 1989. The program started out very vigorously, and then the growth in the program began to level off, and in the last several years it has declined. So we think that one way to make the practice environment better for rural physicians and others affected by this credit would be to increase the credit and keep up with the rising costs of the consumer price index, medical consumer price index, and adjust it in that way. So I would certainly be happy to answer any questions that the committee has about the way we manage this tax credit, and then I would defer to Scott and Ed.
Thank you, Karen. Ed?
Mr. Chairman, Ed Patterson with the Oregon Rural Health Association. Mr. Chairman, as I think you know, I just retired a couple years ago from being chief lobbyist for the Oregon Association of Hospitals, and part of that, I spent 12 years as a rural hospital administrator. And recruiting physicians to a rural hospital is just almost a full-time job. And you asked the question, I think my friend Boquist asked the question, whether this is effective or not. I have to tell you that Scott and I were in on the ground floor when we put this together and originally passed back in 1989. And in representing the hospitals and talking to the rural hospital administrators, it was very effective. The problem is it's now 15 years old, and I think it's time to up the ante because the competition for recruiting doctors is really getting tough, not just for rural hospitals, but for large hospitals, too. So we're fighting doctors who could make a decision to practice in an urban area and make at least 20 or 25% more money than they can in a rural area. And this sends a strong signal, not so much the $10,000 or the $5,000. It sends a signal that this state is serious about recruiting physicians to rural areas. And that mindset is what a lot of the rural hospitals use to convince doctors to come to their small town and to, at a young age with a young family, have $120,000 in education debt and set up a practice. And it has worked very well. So we would encourage your support.
Ed, just one question relative to the staff observation that 63 licensees or 63 returns had two licensees. Was that originally intended that if you could get a nurse and a doctor in the same area, a registered nurse, whether or not she works for the doctor or works for the hospital, was that intended?
Mr. Chair, I don't know that we even thought about that back 15 years ago, but I have to tell you that as far as I'm concerned, more power to them. But when you're recruiting doctors and his wife happens to be another doctor or his wife happens to be a nurse or some other health profession, you probably need them too. And if you don't make the spouse happy, the doctor's not going to stay. So it's I think it's a bonus that we didn't anticipate.
Thank you. Roxanne Berger?
Or maybe the wife is a doctor and the husband is a nurse. Thank you.
I'm just curious. I mean, you may not have seen this, but I mean, Lizbeth has indicated that there were 95 medical practitioners who qualified, and they spent $649,000 in taxes, but they had qualified for the credit, but didn't use the credit. Any comment on why 95 people who were eligible for the credit didn't use it?
They didn't have the chair as their accountant.
Mr. Chair, Representative Boquist, it's possible they're not aware of the credit, that they don't have an accountant who's made them aware of it. Every year we get calls from several practitioners who say, we didn't know about this credit, and then they can file amended returns for, I think, the past 3 years, and they generally do that if they've been eligible for those years. But there are some who are not aware of it.
Let me just share with you, colleagues. We had the health committee meet with the education committee. Have both met out in Baker County. I have an MD out in Baker County who is in his 70s, who came before the committee and broke down in tears. He'd like to retire. But he practices, I think, one day a week up in John Day and one day a week out in Burns. Provides them the only obstetric care that they have in those two communities. 73, I think, years old, and incidentally is a county commissioner. Serves on a couple of water boards and other local boards, trying to do everything they can to keep that thing together. And he just broke down in tears. He said, "I'd like to be able to do this, but if I retire, then we're not going to have obstetric care." And one of the things that he was concerned about was that he's looking at, and he told us how much his practice was making. It's a matter of public record, and he's not going to be able to use the credit because by the time he's done paying his professional liability, working full time, and I say working full time. I'm going to guess working full-time in a medical practice out there, including the other two hospitals, is probably only 60 or 70 hours a week. And then working the other part-time as a county commissioner, as a other volunteer for so many other kinds of things that this great man does. And you look at it and you say, well, wait a minute, you could go juice up your income a whole bunch. And saying, hey, that isn't what it's about, folks. He's there doing the kinds of things that he's doing because he loves the community, loves the people, and he's really concerned about what happens when he has to hang up his shingles. And that's there are folks that are entitled to $5,000 and that aren't using that credit because they're just not making that much money. this in a particularly in an obstetric practice in rural Oregon with a I don't know, our family physician retired when left the active practice of delivering our children and being a general physician. When they said next year we'll only double your and it was already nearly $100,000, next year we'll only double your medical liability insurance if you promise not to deliver any more children. And he went to work for the Bureau of Indian Affairs in Oklahoma. He just said, I can't do this anymore. I want to be a physician. I want to be able to work for families, but I'm willing to go work for the BIA, for the government, where I don't have to fight this issue continually. And it was a lot of money. I was his accountant, and I could see that it wasn't a lot of money that he was making in Ontario, and it wasn't going to be a lot more money. As a matter of fact, I think overall it was less, but it was less hassle, too, to go out and work for the BIA because he could spend his full time. And there again, I was probably full time as to, you know, 8 in the morning until 8 in the evening, just half days. But anyway, he wanted to do that so he could be a physician. So I just really feel for these folks that want to do this and can't use the credit because they just don't have the income. And I've seen it time after time in my practice. It wasn't because I wasn't trying to get the credit for them. It wasn't because I was necessarily forgetting to take the credit. It was just that they just don't have the income there in rural Oregon. Representative Galizia, you had a question?
Well, first I guess I declare a conflict of interest because my wife is a nurse practitioner. She works for Clackamas County in Molalla. But having said that, can I still talk?
No.
Please. Yeah. Put that to a vote here.
Do we have a motion?
Just to respond to what Representative Boquist said. We have, my wife and I have what I think is a good CPA. And it was really through happenstance that we found out that she was eligible for that $5,000 tax credit. I mean, it was just in conversation at the office. So our tax preparer was not aware of it. And it was, so I guess my question is, can't you do a better job of alerting people that seriously, I mean, where does that, she works for the county. You would think the county would have told her, but
Mr. Chair, Representative Galizio, we do try to just blanket the professionals with this information. The problem, we certainly do notify all the county health departments. They're on our mailing list. The problem with nursing practice is the way the records are kept with the Board of Nursing, the address is usually their residence address, not their home, not their practice address. So we don't always sort out who is actually eligible. We don't do a good job of notifying them because we can't reach them. We don't have their actual practice address to determine whether or not they're eligible. And I think another issue is people just get so much mail that they don't always see what they're getting, and that could apply certainly to their employers and to the county health departments. But I'm sorry your wife didn't know about it. The other tool, I'm trying to figure out if it's somebody else's. But the other tool we rely on is the professional associations. Also, I know the medical association has been a big help in letting their members know, and I know the nursing association also tries to do that. So sometimes it just slips by, and I really apologize.
Well, maybe we could offer a credit to the accountant so that they could stay up on top of it.
There you go.
Just for clarification, Mr. Chair, so you know, I wasn't meaning that rural doctors out there. I was specifically talking about those who were, in fact, certified by the Office of Rural Health but didn't use the credit. They knew about it. They just didn't use the credit for whatever reason. I would fully agree with you. In the rural areas, we have challenges.
Well, and there's just occasionally, and I've got to say this as an accountant, there's just occasionally that one of those doctors will foolishly go out and buy a ranch or a farm and a few cows, and then pretty soon they're in real trouble. In real trouble. So, Scott?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I won't belabor this issue too much longer, but I kind of want to mention what the future looks like in rural Oregon and in the recruitment of physicians. And not just there, actually, but statewide. It's particularly acute in rural Oregon. The largest bubble of physicians today are between 50 and 60 years of age. These individuals most certainly are going to retire soon or sooner for a variety of reasons, the pressures of liability, as you know, increased practice costs and everything else. We simply do not have the capacity to produce in Oregon, and never have had the ability to produce in Oregon, a sufficient number of physicians to replace those who are going to retire, not only in rural Oregon, but statewide.
Scott, I need your name for the record.
I'm sorry, Scott Gallant, Oregon Medical Association. I apologize. This is a very troubling a problem that the state faces. We have always recruited physicians from out of state in order to fill the needs of the state. In some eras, we have recruited more than we have easily in the past. For the first time in about 4 or 5 decades, the line showing population increases going up and physician number of practicing physicians crossing the wrong way just occurred last year. And we are literally in a national and worldwide competition for physicians to reside and practice in Oregon. Most states are trying to get the best and the brightest. They have programs that provide incentives to go to all over the country, and we're competing for those physicians. They may practice anywhere in the country and in some instances in the world, and we have to be aware of that. This is a very, in our opinion, a very critical factor, a beginning factor in trying to address this issue that is going to become very acute in the very near future, in the medical association's opinion. Thank you.
Thank you, Scott. Scott Ekblad and Karen, I'm going to ask you to work probably in conjunction with the Oregon Medical Association. Maybe you could tell us what other states are doing. Do you have that information to show what other states are doing in this regard to try and attract these medical professionals, particularly in the rural portions of their states?
Mr. Chair, I don't have it at my fingertips right here, but we certainly have access
and
to that
Oregon's
information.
And Oregon's 5,000, is it paltry compared to other states?
Oregon is one of only about 7 states that offers a tax credit, but okay. Other states do things like loan repayment. You know, a physician leaves medical school these days with anywhere from $150,000 to $200,000 in debt, and so we have a very modest loan repayment program here in Oregon, but some states have very significant loan repayment programs, or they may have scholarship programs that are then tied to service in rural areas. And the National Office of Federal Office of Rural Health does maintain some information on that, and we'll certainly get it for you.
Ed, as I recall, too, the rural hospitals go in and actually are assisting by giving bonuses in the form of reduction and where they pay directly to the student loan certain amounts too.
Mr. Chairman, somehow some of the rural hospitals do that. Unfortunately, they're all not quite in the financial state where they can do that. But some do, I know.
But I mean, in order to even track the doctor in that knows how to do stitches or those kinds of things. I know that the Ontario Hospital offers special bonuses of X number of dollars for a doctor who will come in with specialized in internal medicine or those kinds of things. So,
Mr. Chairman, I attached to my testimony this article. It's about 3 years old. It's a little dated Oregon Business Magazine article. And I know you folks got more reading than you can handle, but if you have an opportunity to read it, it really gives an excellent, accurate flavor of what's happening in rural areas.
Someone from Vernonia that's practicing, huh?
Well, there's one there in John Day, too.
Oh, okay. All right. Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Thank you. We appreciate your attendance.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. And let's see, Jane, would you want to come forward, please? Jane Myers, Oregon Dental Association.
Jane Myers, Oregon Dental Association, and we're giving you a written comment of support for House Bill 3348. About 52 dentists, according to the Office of Rural Health, get this tax credit, and they're in very remote parts of the state because the Office of Rural Health has designated frontier counties, and I think it's a very small cities that are more than 30 miles from another opportunity for someone to see a dentist. They have to have an agreement with the local hospital, and they've been audited by the Office of Rural Health and found that that's really working rather well for them. So we would encourage your support of the bill.
Thank you very much, Jane. Questions for Oregon Dental Association Representative Jane Myers? Thank you again, Jane. Appreciate it. Colleagues, thank you very much for working through with us on House Bill 3348. We'll now close the public hearing on House Bill 3348 and reopen the public hearing on 3407.
Chairman Butler and committee members, with House Bill 3407, this is dealing with the charitable checkoff contributions on your personal income tax form. So it's establishing a new charitable checkoff for contributions to the Oregon Health Plan from a personal income tax refund. So it specifies that if the space is available, the Oregon Health Plan charitable checkoff be placed on the face of the Oregon personal income tax return. It establishes the Oregon Health Plan charitable checkoff contribution account in the state treasury, separate and distinct in the general fund, and monies from the Oregon Health Plan charitable checkoff account are continuously appropriated to DHS for the purpose of funding medical assistance payments under the Oregon Health Plan. It applies to biennium years beginning after the effective date of this act, takes effect 91 days after the end of a legislative session. So I haven't done a revenue impact yet, but basically I also gave you the summary in 2003 of what the charitable checkoffs were as far as the amount of contributions that were made. And basically, as you can see, this first column there shows you the charities, and the ones that are shaded there are the ones that are on the front in the actual, on the form itself, on the tax form. Then you have additional ones that are in the instructions themselves. So you basically have these five listed, and then you have other. So then the other includes all, then you go to the instruction sheet, and then you see these various others. So it seems you can hear from the Department of Revenue, but I don't think there is additional room on the tax form itself to add the Oregon Health Plan. So they would probably have to go in the other section. But you can see there, as far as the number of filers donating, there was 10,122 donated versus basically in the total dollars that were donated, there was 163,598. So basically this, but you can see so many, a lot of it was right up there with the total amount of those five contributions. So they really, you know, contributed the lion's share, was contributed to particular charities that are on the form itself. So basically over 80%, or actually 79%, were actually for those five that were there. So basically that's the background here as far as going through how you actually get on the list. Is in 2003 there were 18 charities that taxpayers could contribute to, and three of those were authorized by statute to be listed permanently on the face of the personal income tax return. And then that was the Oregon Non-Game Wildlife, the first three there, the child abuse, and then the Alzheimer's disease research. Then two other charities, the Stop Domestic and Sexual Violence, and then the AIDS HIV research, were ones that have continued to receive more than 50,000 in contributions in at least one of the last two previous tax years to ensure that they're allowed to stay on the face of the tax return. So in 2003, there was an additional, again, 13, which are the ones there that aren't shaded, of other charities that were listed in the Oregon Personal Income Tax Instruction Booklet. So to be eligible, private programs must have a tax-deductible charitable status and must collect 10,000 signatures and have gross income of at least $1 million. The cost of administering the checkoff program are paid directly from the contributions. There's a maximum of 1% of the charitable contributions that can be used to reimburse the general fund for those costs incurred by the commission. So basically, the Oregon Charitable Checkoff Commission is the one that's defining each year the eligibility and decides which charitable programs will be listed on the Oregon Personal Income Tax Form and instructions each year.
Okay, thank you very much. Elizabeth?
And Chairman Butler, just so everyone's clear, this does have a referral to Ways and Means.
Okay, thank you. Kelly? And let's see, Donald Pfeiffer? I understand we're waiting also for... Senator Bates has done as well. Welcome, Kelly. We appreciate you taking your time for your busy schedule.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Representative Kelly Worth, State Representative for House District 16. I apologize for having my laptop at our printer is doing evil things up in the office, so I don't know what's going on. But anyway, so I apologize. But I want to thank you very much for hearing House Bill 3407 this afternoon, and I'd like to say a few words in support of the legislation and urge your support of it. I've had the privilege of sponsoring House Bill 3407, as you know, at the request of my constituent, Mr. Donald Pfeiffer. And I come from an area, I'm very fortunate to have a number of constituents, Representative Hass's aunt is one of them, with thoughtful ideas that have really, they're the basis of the most of my bills, and they're very well thought out, concrete solutions to many of our state's troubling issues. And Mr. Pfeiffer is certainly one of those constituents. But his story and his bill are unique. The story behind this bill is especially inspiring. The journey that he has taken to be here with us today is a textbook example of how a bill becomes law. House Bill 3407 arose out of this one individual Oregonian's will to do the right thing for his state and his fellow Oregonians, and his plan to achieve that goal. Don is just one single Oregonian who saw a need in our state and decided to do something about it. After a lot of hard work, determination, and the guts to ask a lot of questions and a lot of phone calling, Don came up with a solution to the need he sought to fix. He wanted to find a way to do his part to help minimize the suffering of his fellow Oregonians who lack access to adequate health care. He wanted to find a way to do his part to help the state in its struggle over health care issues and funding. And the bill that you see before you today is the product of that. He will tell you his long journey story, how it finally wound up to Dr. Bates and I. And it's just, rarely have you ever seen a bill's story actually go along the chart that how a bill becomes law. But this is exactly how a one single Oregonian can get something done and change things. Just in support, I know that the charitable checkoff is a controversial issue just because of the size limit and the state of the funding and the competition for where it gets placed in the income tax form. But I think Don will give you a very good case of why the Oregon Health Plan deserves and merits being included in the charitable checkoff program up front on the income tax form itself. If our goal is to bring in money, obviously, the Oregon Health Plan, while these other the charitable checkoffs included on the income tax form are certainly more than worthy causes, the Oregon Health Plan has got name recognition, and over and poll after poll after poll, Oregonians cite the Oregon Health Plan is one of the most popular and programs and most highly supported programs in the state. So with this, it's got name recognition, is well known, very very high support amongst Oregonians. It seems like it's just a natural fit for the charitable checkoff program. And given the lack of funding or the difficulty in funding the Oregon Health Plan and the rising cost, this just seems like a natural marriage between Oregonians who have a program that they're very supportive of, and a way for them to help us fund that program. I do want to say that it's a sad day that we come to having to fund Oregon Health Plan through the charitable checkoff program. But again, if this is one way to that citizens can help fix the revenue problem and the funding problem, then so be it. And I just appreciate Don Pfeiffer for bringing the idea to me and to Dr. Bates. And who wants to go next? Do you want to?
Whichever. I don't know. How much time do we have?
Senator Bates.
Be about 5 to 7 minutes.
Okay, I still got to get back up to
it. Senator Bates, we know your schedule is busy as well. We appreciate your being down here.
I'm having a very busy day this morning and this afternoon, I should say, as we go along. Mr. Chair and the fellow members of the committee, for the record, I'm Alan Bates. I'm a family physician in Southern Oregon. I also have to be a state senator. This bill came to my attention. The gentleman to our right, and by a former governor, called me up and told me to do it too. I don't know what connection you have with him, but obviously you do. And I thought it was a good idea. I still do think it's a good idea. The Oregon Health Plan is our Medicaid program in the state. For every dollar you put in, you get a 2-to-1 match from the federal government. When this money goes into the plan, while it may seem small, you get a 2-to-1 bump for it. And that's a nice match to have in any program I've ever been in. The health plan is broken into two parts now. One is the categorical part, which is being maintained, as it always has, at about 350,000 people. The major expansion of the plan was what we call HP standard, which at one point was a little over 100,000 people, and is now down to 45,000 people. And that's because of the lack of general funds for it, even though we get that 2-to-1 match, we're losing that match now. As we have more and more people become uninsured, those costs are shared by all of us, and cost shifting at hospitals, emergency rooms, and other areas raise their own personal premiums. This bill is not going to change the Oregon Health Plan or put it on its feet financially, but it's a step in the right direction. I think it raises people's awareness of the plan, and I think a lot of people, a few physicians wouldn't mind checking this off as a refund to the back of the plan. So I think it's a good idea. I appreciate you bringing it forward, and I always like to see a citizen step up and try to do something for the state. I appreciate your work. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Senator. Mr. Feigl?
Am I excused, sir?
Senator, we know that you're busy. Thank you very much. You've honored us with your presence.
Thank you.
We do appreciate your
time. Good to see you all.
Thanks. I'm glad to meet you.
Good to meet you, too. You take care.
Thanks.
Am I next?
So I'd like to introduce my constituent, Don Feigl. For the record,
Chair Bates, honored members of the committee, I am both honored and humbled that a citizen such as I am allowed to speak before an elite group such as this. My name is Donald Pfeiffer, and I live at 720 Northwest 35th in Corvallis, Oregon, 97330. I am in favor of this legislation, obviously, since I initiated it, and I am thankful that I come before you today, not to lay another problem on your weary shoulders, but to suggest a solution to an ongoing problem, namely funding of the Oregon Health Care Plan. This all started several years ago when the surtax was on the ballot, and I don't mind saying I voted for the surtax, and when it was defeated, I was disappointed, and I felt financially able to, and I wanted to do my share. So I spent an afternoon on phone calls to state agencies, and I found out that it's indeed possible to contribute money to the state, although the state employees weren't exactly sure that it could be designated for a specific plan, but they found out that it could. So I calculated what my surtax would have been, and I mailed a check to the cashier in the Department of Administrative Services and designated it to be used for the Oregon Health Plan. And after this, I was quite excited that you could do this, and I realized that my little contribution was just a drop in the bucket. So I went and I contacted some of the news media and told them about it, and they were all very polite to me, but they really didn't do anything. They didn't follow it up. And sometime later, I attended a lecture at Oregon State University by a lady, Barbara Ehrenreich, who is author of Nickel and Dime, Not Getting By in America. And it was in LaSalle Stewart Center. And after the lecture, there was a bunch of booths that you could visit from various agencies in Benton County. And I happened to stop by Benton County Democrats, and I met Dave Conklin and told him about it. And he said, well, why don't you present this idea to Benton County Democrats? So I went there, and I presented the idea, and they all thought it was a great idea, and they all voted unanimously for it. Well, this was the place that I met Kelly, and she said that she would follow up on it. And in the meantime, a little bit of time elapsed, and during this time, I wrote a letter to former Governor Dr. Kitzhoffer, and I got a very nice letter back from him, and he said he thought that the plan had some merit, and this encouraged me all the more. Later on last fall, I met Kelly again, and she promised to write this up as a bill, and in the meantime, everyone I've talked to has seemed to think that it was a good idea. And so Kelly wrote the bill up, and I saw it early, about February or March, I believe it was. And this is the path that I've followed in bringing this before you today. And I thank you very much for allowing me to speak. And I'll be happy to answer any questions if there are any.
Thank you, Mr. Pfeiffer. I had just one comment relative to the two-for-one that was mentioned. I think that means that for each dollar that's collected under the Oregon Health Plan, that you can get a dollar and a half reimbursement from federal. Is that right, Kelly? Is that what I understood?
It's the reimbursement rate.
Okay. Questions of either Representative Worth or Mr. Pfeiffer? Yes, Representative Boquist.
Thank you. Representative, on page 2 of your bill, mm-hmm. if you have it, you go down to line 20 and 21. And the reason I raise this question is in Veterans, we have several bills similar to this. And before Deborah Buchanan gets grilled here, if you look down there at line 21, it talks about the space shall provide for checkoff boxes in 1, 5, 10, or other amount. One of the challenges that Oregon Department of Revenue has brought up in another committee of mine is this, because you have the 1, 5, and 10, therefore you're limited to just, I think, those 6. Is that right, Deborah? There's 6 on the main form that you can fit on the actual tax form. And what we've come to the conclusion is, if you look at the list, if you're one of those 6, you get lots of money, and it's a self-fulfilling prophecy because you're above $50,000. And if you're not one of those 6, then you don't get the money. You see what happens in the back deal. One of the suggestions in another committee we talked about is maybe changing that designation to say something like just $5 or other. What we're trying to do is identify space savings. So therefore, instead of having the 6, you may be able to put more on that front page, which of course would encourage more philanthropic actions, not only for the Oregon Health Plan, but for other people on that line. What do you think of that idea just in general? Because we have like 3 more bills I know come in this committee. Reference.
Mr. Yes. Chair, Representative Boquist, I guess I understand both sides of the argument. I guess after I've done the research and kind of spent a lot of time with this issue, I've flipped my position, and I do see the value in the the wisdom in keeping the number of organizations that are on the tax form itself limited to a few, and maybe not watering it down, but really putting those programs out there that have got some serious, you know, not only I don't know, popularity, sympathy, but you know, a desire amongst and a motivation amongst folks, individual citizens, to step up to the plate and do something about. So I think I would be a proponent of remaining just the 6 or 7 would be great. And then, you know, we have to set, and it can't be first come, first serve. I mean, we've really got to, I think it would be best to look at it and set it in terms of priority. And really, if we're out to bring in money, then that's the Oregon Health Plan would be the money maker, in the sense that, again, people know the program. It's poll after poll after poll, wildly popular, and people know it's in trouble and it needs help funding given the increase in costs and everything. So I think that's a point of, you know, where legislators can decide on whether or not we want to, I don't want to say water it down, but make it more open, or if we really want to target programs, but then it would be a prioritizing kind of exercise. So that's what I would.
Follow up Representative Boquist.
And this is not no response you give us to the committee notes. There's like three more bills. I know they're already coming out of committees on the way here. And like Representative Compass is familiar with this problem here. Is that the research we found is, again, if you're one of the six on the front, yeah. you get something. And then the way the statute is written now, if you're above the $50,000 mark, you're back on the sheet. I mean, that's one of the requirements. You automatically file in there, or you have to have a certain amount of signatures, and then there's actually a commission or a committee that makes the determination. And that's all not in the legislature. That's kind of
right.
Out there. So the problem is you can't get to seven. We already tried that in another committee. And so you either have to have a rotating basis to do this, or you have to make it fit the form better, which means, you know, you either put more on with less information, or you set up a rotating schedule, one of the two. And I don't know if you have comments that represent work. I mean, there are two other bills coming this way about the same thing. And so at some point, the committees have to make a decision, yes, no, or do nothing.
Mr. Chair, Representative Boquist, I guess I would, you know, we could set guidelines, or the commission could set guidelines on what type of charitable organizations would take a priority over others. Mm-hmm. And, you know, again, one could be, you know, the potential for bringing in actual contributions, you know, the efficacy of the organization's mission, et cetera. So I like both ideas. I know it's a difficult thing because none of these organizations, and these are all great causes and certainly in no less need than the Oregon Health Plan. But I think it's important to capitalize on the will and the just the knowledge of this program with the vast population of Oregon. So,
thank you.
Thank you, Representative Boquist is recognized. I'm sorry, Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to comment to Mr. Pfeiffer that I deeply appreciate your thinking on this and your willingness to step forward after the defeat of Measure 30, which was pretty resounding at the polls. Everybody read letters to the editor that said, well, if those people want to, you know, give to the government, let them give to the government. And there stands before us a gentleman who said, there's a need here, and I'm willing to step forward and on a personal basis and support the folks that are receiving services through the Oregon Health Plan and desperately need them. So I thank you, sir, very much. That being said, I do have questions about this specific proposal, and I know that there are other folks who can answer them with regard to how to administer this kind of fund and what it means, because it isn't a traditional it's to the government. It isn't to a traditional charity, so you understand that it would have some special pieces around it that I think that this committee needs to carefully consider. But thank you, sir, very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Representative Riley is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, Representative Boquist in his follow-up asked my question, but he also triggered another one for me, and that is, if we're going to look at, you know, what gets placed on the front of the form, one of the things we might look at is what brings in the most federal dollars with it.
Thank you. Excellent observation. Other questions from committee members? Thank you very much, Mr. Pfeiffer. We're honored to have you here and appreciate you bringing forward this great idea. And thank you, Representative Kelly Worth. We're appreciative of you taking your time out of your busy schedule. We're honored to have you here. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair Rutland. Appreciate the chance to hear this bill, and we will give the testimony too.
Thank you. Colleagues, that completes our schedule for the day, and tomorrow we'll be back in session again.
regular time. Any other questions or concerns? Hearing seeing none, we will close the public hearing on 3407 and close the Revenue Committee for the day.